It's WS2N.
Yeah, hi, Paul. How you doing? Go ahead.
Well, one comment and then one question. The comment is that the crackling noise is on Selden as well, so you probably know that. The question I have is, this reflectometer, is that the same gadget you would use? Let's say you had a break in the line and you weren't sure where it was, maybe, you know, 50 feet down the line, and you just weren't sure. There's some kind of a gadget. Was that the gadget that tells you where the break is, sends a frequency down, and you could, determine that?
Okay, did you give it back to me?
Do you answer?
I wasn't sure. Did you drop it? Because you unkeyed abruptly. Did you give it back?
I probably said back to you, Andy, after I dropped it. Back to you, Andy.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that's a good question, because what you're referring to is actually called a time domain reflectometer. So if you want to call it that, I call it a time domain reflectometer, which actually measures you can measure the distance on a line to a short or an open or a termination using that device, a time domain reflectometer. So you could call it that if you want, but the actual name that I've been using is that. Actually, I have one. And hopefully, if we ever do a live HRU again, and not something on Zoom, maybe I can demonstrate how it works, a time domain reflectometer, because it actually will show where a short or an open or some perturbed, I guess they use that, occurrence at a certain point in the line. It will show that location. So that's a time domain reflectometer, as opposed to a simple SWR meter, or a reflectometer that I call it in this book. So, does that clear it up?
It does, and when you said the big long name, that rung a bell. I remember that from Dick mentioning that a number of times. Okay, back to you, Andy.
Yeah, you are hearing what I'm talking about. Transmission lines are kind of interesting puppies. They do a lot of stuff. And as you can see, it's a lengthy discussion because it's more than just a piece of coax cable. And depending on how you're terminating it, will cause some interesting effects. And if you follow along, you could actually, see what I'm talking about here. So it's good. It's a good subject, and I like it. It's kind of lengthy, though. Many more pages ahead, but we're gonna, extend this. Okay, let me let it drop, and I'll continue. All right. So continuing here, as I just mentioned, a half-wave line again repeats the impedance at the input, so that the generator works into a very low or short-circuited impedance, and that's what the line shorted. So if you take a half-wave line and you short it at the other end, your generator that's generating is going to see that short, half-wave length away. All right, so no matter what the value of load resistance is used between the short circuit and the open circuit values for the termination, the input impedance of that line assumes an identical value. So, and that's something to keep in mind, because a half wavelength away, that generator is going to see that impedance, whatever it is. Even if the termination is an inductance or a capacitance, the line input impedance appears the same as the termination to the generator. Since the voltage and current conditions of the standing wave repeat each half wavelength, the same one-to-one transformer action is present for any number of half wavelengths on the line. So in other words, what they're saying is every half wavelength away, you go one half wavelength away, you're going to see that impedance. You go another half wavelength, you're going to see that impedance. You go another half wavelength, you're going to see that impedance. It just keeps repeating and repeating and repeating. Again, this is the basis for the for that article, impedance matching with transmission lines. Well, if they're going to use this, they're going to use it to our advantage. So now what we're going to do is we're going to go, instead of a half wave, we're going to go a quarter wave, which is a half of a half. So a quarter wave is going to be 90 degrees as opposed to 180 degrees. So again, this is an illustration. A quarter wavelength section of line, as shown here, causes an inversion of the termination. So whatever I just said, now flip it around, which also makes sense, because if you're going to have a high impedance, now you're going to have a low impedance, depending on if it's open or shorted. You know, if the end of the line is terminated, unterminated, which will be open or shorted because it's a shorted line. So a quarter wavelength section of the line will cause an inversion of the termination. With an open circuit quarter wavelength section of the line, the standing wave pattern as such that the generator sees a low...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I just want to start reading this this one paragraph again. A quarter wave section of line, as shown is in the figure that I'm seeing, causes an inversion of the termination. With an open circuit quarter wavelength section of line, as shown in figure, this figure that I'm looking at, the standing wave pattern is such that the generator sees a low impedance, which is a current maximum and a voltage minimum. So when your impedance is low, your current goes up and your voltage goes down. So theoretically, the impedance would be zero if the line had no losses. There is always some loss in a practical line, but the impedance is still very low. So the waves along one line are shown above and along the other below, which is actually, again, the illustration that we're referring to. Stand by 1 second. I will be right back. WHCDO. Stand by. Okay, sorry about that. I had a quick call. A little interruption. WHCDO. Back. So I'm just going to repeat what I just said. We'll let it drop. Okay, so there's always some losses in a practical line, but the impedance is still very low. The waves along one line are shown above and along the other below, which again is the illustration. A shorted quarter wave section reflects a high impedance to the generator. So you have a shorted quarter wave section, now you're going to have a high impedance at the end of the line, at the quarter wave length away, and the generator is going to see that. So the high impedance will be a voltage maximum and a current minimum. It will be just the opposite as just having a low impedance. Again, if the line had no losses, it will reflect an infinite impedance. The standing waves on one line are shown above, and again, they're showing an illustration of what this looks like. But again, you know, if you just, you don't have to visualize it, you just understand the way I'm saying it. You just know that if you have a shorter line, or if you have an open line, a quarter wavelength away, or a half wavelength away, you know what the impedance should be back at the generator end. And that's what you have to know for now. Again, you know, we'll use these little idiosyncrasies that occur, you know, to our advantage for matching. And we have, we could use different wavelengths. We don't even have to use quarter wave or half wave. We could use odd wavelengths, like, you know, 1/8 wave, 2/8, 5/8, 6/8, 6/8, 12/8, you know, whatever we want as far as the wavelength is concerned. Well, there's a number of articles that refer to that also. on odd number of wavelengths away to match an impedance. So, let me let it drop. Okay, so the impedance reversing characteristic of a quarter wave section of line is an important one. And that's why I'm repeating it a number of times, because you have to understand, you know, how we can use this in the future. It means that when the load resistance is less than the characteristic impedance of the line, the generator sees a resistance higher than the characteristic impedance of the line. A converse relationship exists when the load impedance is higher than the surge impedance of the line. In fact, a quarter wavelength section of line of the proper surge impedance can be used as an ideal matching transformer to match the impedance of the source to the impedance of the load. Okay, right there, that's the bingo term. And if you want to say bingo, that's the reason why, about impedance matching with transmission lines. So here it says in this particular book, and this is the reason why I'm explaining it this way, because the QSC article is not actually going into this discussion, is the reason why we can match impedances with transmission lines. So I'm going to repeat this again because it's important to note this. Let me let it drop. Okay, the impedance reversing characteristic of a quarter wave section of line is an important one. And we're talking about a quarter wave, not a half wave. This is a quarter wave. It means that when the load resistance is less than the characteristic impedance of the line, the generator sees a resistance higher than the characteristic impedance of the line. And a converse relationship exists when the load impedance is higher than the surge impedance of the line. So, in fact, a quarter wave section of line of the proper surge impedance can be used as an ideal matching transformer to match the impedances of the source to the impedance of the load. Okay, so there you go. There's the actual reason why this occurs, because of this relationship. And they showed this in a number of illustrations. It shows that an open circuit line of various lengths may have different input impedances. And, for example, we have an open circuit line that is shorter than a quarter wavelength. So now we're going to actually have less than a quarter wavelength. The line appears to the generator as a capacitor and is made up largely of the capacity between the wires themselves. So now you see, or you're hearing, I should say, that, you know, we're using transmission lines as circuit elements. You know, an element being a capacitor, an inductor, or a combination of both, to create a parallel resonant circuit, a series resonant circuit, or whatever you want to do with it. So they show if you're less than a quarter wave length away, we already know when it's exactly a quarter wave and a half wave because we just discussed that. But now we're going to do it a little bit less than a quarter wave. So now you're going to have an odd number of wavelengths. Instead of it being an even wavelength, like a half or a quarter, it's going to be a little bit less or a little bit more. So if it's less than a quarter wave, it becomes a capacitor. If it's exactly a quarter wave, and this is interesting, it's a series resonant circuit that comprises a capacitor and an inductor. And I'm not reading this, I'm just illustrating the article, or, you know, giving you the illustration that I'm seeing here, just so you can see it. That's exactly a quarter wave. If it's greater than a quarter wave but less than a half wave, now it becomes an inductor. Now it's inductance. Inductive, I should say.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
All right, W8-2CDO. Seems like the static disappeared. I shouldn't talk. Okay, so again, if it's greater than a quarter wave but less than a half wave, it becomes an inductor. And guess what? Now, if it's exactly a half wave, less than a quarter wave, it's a capacitor. exactly a quarter wave. It's a series resonant circuit with a capacitor and inductor. If it's less than a quarter wave, but if it's greater than a quarter wave but less than a half wave, it's an inductor, simply an inductor. But if it's exactly a half wave, I didn't mean a quarter wave, if it's exactly a half wave, it's now a parallel resonant circuit. So it's just the opposite. Instead of it being a series resonant circuit, now it's a parallel resonant circuit. And we know that a series resonant circuit at resonance, the impedance is low because of its resonant characteristics, the capacitor cancels the inductor, and all you're left with is the resistor in the circuit. And consequently, when it's with the parallel resonant circuit, and I'm not reading that, I'm just telling you. If it's a parallel resonant circuit at resonance, it's a high impedance. And that's the characteristics of a parallel resonant as opposed to series resonant circuit. Now, again, we're going to use these characteristics as going back to the article to match impedances. So keep that in mind. All right, let me let it drop and just look at something here so I can just review it. Okay. WA2CDL. So, a line that is longer than one quarter wavelength, as I just mentioned, a line that is longer than one quarter wavelength but shorter than a half wavelength appears to the generator as an inductance. Okay, now, why this phenomenon occurs, and this is what they say, this is why this is so, can be more easily understood if we break the line, and they show it in an illustration of what the line is, looks like if it's broken. A small portion of the line at the right is shorter than one quarter wavelength. So they show a line that's less than one quarter wavelength. Therefore, it appears as a capacitance, which I just said. The quarter wavelength portion of the line to the left, however, inverts this capacitance so that the generator sees an inductance. So, aha, you see, now you really have to understand this, because now you're going to invert the capacitance and make it into an inductor if it's shorter than one quarter wavelength away. So, again, you have to follow along a little bit closer because it gets a little bit more complicated. So, the quarter wavelength portion of the line, however, inverts the capacitance so that the generator sees an inductance. For a half wavelength line, as is shown again in another illustration, the open circuit is repeated at the generator, where the voltage is maximum and the current is minimum. The input to the line, therefore, resembles a high impedance parallel resonant circuit. So, again, see, now you're going to actually see a certain number of wavelengths away what your circuit, you know, what the transmission line is doing as far as it being a circuit element or a combination of elements. So, again, if it's less than a quarter wavelength away, it's going to look like an inductor. If it's exactly a quarter wavelength, it's going to be a parallel resonant circuit. If it's greater than a quarter wavelength but less than a half wave, it's going to be a capacitor. And if it's exactly a half wave, it's going to be a series resonant circuit with a capacitor and inductor. So, short...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, WA2CDL is back. So, just keep in mind, we were talking about an open line, now we're talking about a shorted line. Shorted circuited lines behave in a similar but not identical manner. So, short circuited lines of various lengths are shown, now this is another illustration. So, in figure 15, notice that the short circuited line that is shorter than one quarter wavelength act as an inductance. For a quarter wavelength shorted line, the input impedance is very high because of this inversion characteristic. This is shown, again, there's an illustration on this. So the point that I'm making is that if you have an open line that's a quarter wavelength, it's going to look like a capacitive. If the line is shorted, it's going to look like an inductive. It's just the opposite. And I just went over the four lengths equal to a quarter wave, or less than a quarter wave, exactly a quarter wave, greater than a quarter wave, but less than a half, and a half wave, to show the difference between a shorted line and an open line. And I hope I'm not confusing too many people by saying it the way I'm saying it, but it's the characteristics of the line which makes it look like what I'm illustrating here, what I'm trying to illustrate. All right, Eddie, I think we're going to just wrap it up with one or two more paragraphs, because it's going to get a little bit more involved with this information that I just discussed. And looking at the next page, it's going to go into some losses in the line and some other things here that I see. Which I don't want to get too crazy with this right now, because you have to see what I'm talking about. So let me just ask any questions as far as how I'm explaining this or trying to explain it. This is Andy's Corner, W8CDO. Okay, Bradley, good evening to you. How are you?
Thank you very much, pretty well. I'm trying to rephrase what you said. There is some contradiction, because if the impedance becomes parallel, then automatically all of the frequencies allowed a parallel adjust from the one that is in resonance. And when we're dealing with serious resonance, the inner serious resonance, the one particular frequency of resonance is allowed to pass through and all other are being cut. Let me know. So my understanding is, correct me if I'm wrong, when it comes to dipoles, the half wave configuration of each leg is 1/4 wavelength. It is really the only practical design. This is because the coax connection at the center matches the half wave dipole's natural impedance. That gives the best transfer of energy from the antenna to the coax, and therefore to the radio. A quarter wavelength, total length, dipole have legs of 1/8 of wavelength each. This is not long enough to be efficient receptor, and the center impedance would not be favorable either. So the dipoles of greater wavelengths, which are not odd multipliers of 1/4 of wavelength, not suitable for the coax connection, because their center impedance are too high compared to the coax. I believe we should keep in mind that when it comes to receive only antennas, it's not important to have a perfect impedance match. The transmission, but we're talking about the transmission one. So I would like you to say a few words about how the transmitter reacts when it sees a parallel a resonance, and it's trying to tune to the frequency, let's say 1.8 megahertz, where parallel should automatically cut that frequency and allow all others to pass.
Okay, I'm trying to follow along the way you're explaining it. Basically, as far as what the transmitter sees, what the transmitter sees. And if you have a mismatch on the end of the line, depending on what kind of mismatch it is, if it's inductive, capacitive, parallel, series, whatever it is, the transmitter itself is going to still put out power, but you're going to have obviously a reflected power because of that. mismatch. And, you know, as you know, modern-day transmitters have DSWR protection, which will automatically cut back the power. As far as how much power, all you want to do is you want to get the maximum power to your antenna. That's the bottom line. So you want to match impedances. However the impedance is, whatever it is in a dipole, whatever it is in a beam, you set up and you make a certain matching device to do that, so that your open wire line or router line or coax cable, whatever you're using, will match that to give you the most efficiency, to give you the most power transfer, and that's what you want. As far as how the transmitter behaves when it sees certain reactances on the line, the only thing I can say is if it's got VSWR protection, because your SWR will go up if it's not matched to a good 50 ohm load, to a, you know, a resistive load like it wants to see, your power will cut back. I mean, that's the best way I can explain that as far as the transmitter is concerned. Just keep in mind, Wesley, the reason why I'm mentioning this, okay, and just want, you know, I just have to restate the reason why I'm talking about this, because there's an article on impedance matching using transmission lines. So we have to get the fundamentals down of what a transmission line does and how it resembles certain impedances, being parallel, series, capacitance, inductance, capacitive, inductive, whatever you want it to be, and that's the point, to get that down, as opposed to, you know, what the transmitter sees. You know, who cares what the transmitter sees? It'll just cut back its power. But the article will talk about certain wavelengths of line at certain, purposely certain different characteristic impedances for matching. And that's what the article's about. So, this is...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, WH2CDO. Yeah, so this discussion is mainly about that. I can't go into it any more depth, because I gotta get the fundamentals down as much, as best as I could, to convey that information. All right, so I'm going to move forward here. I'm almost 25 to 10. We started a little bit earlier today, so it's a good hour right now, and that's a good time. I just have two more paragraphs to complete, and then we're done with this, and then we'll move on. Let me just let it drop. Okay. Again, I'm referring to a lot of illustrations because they're showing this. And they're referring to, again, another figure. So if we have a shorted line that is longer than one quarter wavelength, but less than one half wavelength long, in this case, the small portion at the right of the dots appears in inductance. Again, they're referring to an illustration. It's hard to convey that. But a quarter wave section at the left inverts this reactance so that the effective capacitance is presented to the generator. So again, you know, if you have a capacitor at one end, it's going to invert that, and it's going to become an inductor at the opposite end of the of a quarter wave line. And this is we're talking about a shorted line, by the way. These are lines that are shorted. All right, so the electrical length of a transmission line also depends on the frequency of the applied signal. Now, of course, we know that because, you know, a frequency is measured in wavelengths, and the shorter the wavelength, the higher the frequency, as we all know. That's how we tune our dipoles and antennas and so on. You know, a transmission line that's terminated in its own characteristic impedance doesn't care, because you're terminating it and you just have line losses. But the electrical wavelength, again, of a transmission line also depends on the frequency of the applied signal. When the frequency applied to a length of transmission line changes, The impedance at the input will also change because of the electrical length changes. And again, they're showing that as an illustration. In figure 16, the lengths of the lines are the same. With, I'm just adding that in. With a high frequency signal applied, the standing waves will be shown, again, another illustration. Here both the input and output impedances are high. When a lower frequency signal is applied, the terminal impedance is still the same. Of course, the impedance will be the same. That's not going to change. But your phase difference, your location of where your maximum voltage to maximum current is going to change because your frequency is changing. So they show that in this illustration. The input, however, the impedance is considerably lower than, okay. All right, so I gave a lot of information regarding the length of the lines, quarter wavelength, half wavelength, and what it looks like.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
All right, WA2CDO, sorry for the continued timeouts. What I just mentioned this past half hour is important because that's the base. Again, it's the basic, it's the basis for this article that I saw on impedance matching and how the length of a transmission line reflects back to the generator that's generating the signal. So that's important, and it's important because when we want to use transmission lines to match impedances, we're going to, you know, we're using this effect, and we'll go into that when we eventually get into the article. But again, I just had to convey this. I'm almost done with this, but we'll wait till next week. I got two more pages of this coaxial information of how the wave propagates along the line. And we'll talk about line efficiency a little bit. That's pretty straightforward. And then we'll go from there. So once we finish this, then I'll go into the article that I originally found. But this last half hour was important because you had to really see what happens when a line is shorted, when a line is open, and at different wavelengths. So that's it for now for Andy's Corner. I hope everybody got something out of this. 20 to 10. And we'll continue. I'm not sure about next week. Because I got some holidays coming up. But I'll let Roy know. We've got a couple of events happening. So, but we will be continuing our discussion. Thank you very much for listening, guys, and back to Roy, KC2GS, WA2CDO.
WB2GX, huh?
I knew I couldn't get away empty-handed.
Sorry, Andy, I'm sorry for being late. What article was this? What magazine? What issue?
November 2019 QST by Ward Silver. Impedance matching using transmission lines.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay. Yeah, read up on this, and it's interesting. It's a very, I find it a fascinating a subject because of what coax cables can do at various frequencies and sort of open, shorted, and so on, and most people don't see that. They just see it as a piece of wire or a transmission line going from point A to point B. That's it. Thanks. Roy, back to you. WA2CDO.
KC2GS, thank you very much, Andy. Thank you for Andy's Corner, and we all look forward to it in future weeks. We'll figure out the next time for it, and I look forward to that. So, once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the control operator for Vista Linemark Technical Net. I thought maybe we could touch upon a puzzler that I brought up last week. Hopefully someone thought about it. And, basically, the question is, you buy the cheapest Chinese laser pointers, the red, green, and the blue one, and you stick it in your freezer for about 6 hours, and you take it out. Does the cold temperature have any effect on any of them?
2GXM.
Yes, Rich.
Temperature has no effect on the light of any of them.
Okay. Anyone with any other suggestions?
WA2VDH.
Yes, John.
The only thing I think might have an effect is that I know the laser has a reflection back and forth in there. Temperature possibly could change some of the optical characteristics, where it might not be totally reflecting. I know one of the surfaces is supposed to be partially reflecting, so it might change the reflectivity of one of the surfaces, which constitutes the feedback loop for the laser. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, you're right in that, John. It's a resonant optical chamber, so that's why sometimes there are such things as tunable lasers that have multiple lasing frequencies, and by adjusting the dimensions, you slide the resonance across different bands, and you can tune some lasers to different energies. But for the sake of our discussion tonight, I'm going to just generally assume that the dimensions remain the same, even though we all kind of know that temperature can shift them a little bit. But that isn't probably the most important aspect. Anyone else with any suggestions, guesses, comments, inquiries, what have you? Yes, Wesley.
Well, you were talking about laser pointers, so I assumed that you were talking about laser diode. And the use of laser diode is required since it emits discrete and specific wavelength constantly through the consistency of the wavelength, and that depends on the voltage and the current the diode receives. If those parameters are changed, then the wavelength changes as well, even if it is less than a few nanometers, it's a different one. So the wavelength varies, it slightly impacts the behavior of the optics and lenses in the sensor, and might cause a little the decrease in the sensor performance. Other than that, as I've heard a comment, light is made of photons, so temperature doesn't affect it, and to extreme.
Okay. Wesley gave his theory. Anyone else want to propound a theory or an idea or a concept or just refute everything? Feel free.
IQN, Chris. I'm going to suggest that the current draw lowers as temperature drops.
Okay, so if the current is lower, is that going to affect the output of the laser pointer?
Well, I know that...
I'm sorry, you dropped out of the repeater. If you can juice up the gain a little bit or wiggle the antenna, I'd appreciate it. Once again, you dropped out of the repeater. If you can try again, I'd appreciate it. Okay, hopefully he'll get back soon. Wesley sort of kind of strolled around one of the answers. It's not exactly the problem that the output voltage changes and changes the color of the laser. In a red and a blue laser, LED laser, it's dependent upon a quality of the diode in the bandpass. The forward voltage drop is actually the energy that is produced when the light-emitting diodes, and in this case lasers, generate photons. So the higher the forward voltage drop of the diode, the higher the energy of the laser, the higher the frequency, and the the more energetic laser is. So in the red and the blue, it will shift a little bit, about 5 nanometers in bandwidth. It'll become a little bit more energetic photon. But my big question for you guys is, I haven't been talking about the green one at all. So is there something special about green laser pointers?
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I think the green laser pointers actually double. I think they start out as infrared, and then they run it through a nonlinear crystal. I think it's calcite or something, and it doubles infrared to green. I remember reading something about that a few years back. Okay.
Yes, indeed. It's a little bit more complicated. Everything ultimately is a little bit more complicated. The way that they figured out that's cost-effective, it's much cheaper for them to build it this way than build a native green lasing light-emitting diode. So what they do is they build a infrared laser diode. It's near-infrared. It's about 808 nanometers. Now, if you ran that through the frequency-doubling crystals, unfortunately, you'd get light, if the crystal worked for that frequency, you'd get light that was about 404 nanometers, which would be ultraviolet, which would be invisible to us. So you have to play games now with the near-infrared light. The game you play is you use a neodymium crystal that is able to fluoresce. It absorbs the near-infrared at 808 nanometers. It fluoresces far infrared, 164 nanometers. You throw that through the crystal doubler, and it comes out a nice green at 532 nanometers. So my next question for the audience is, okay, you've taken the red, green, and blue laser out of the freezer. You shine the red one, it looks red. You shine the blue one, it looks blue because we can't really tell the difference between that small amount of frequency shift. We take the green one out and we see absolutely nothing. You can turn the lights out and point it around. There's nothing coming out of there. You don't see anything. So the final question of this particular puzzle is it reasonable for you to turn that laser pointer around and look down the barrel and see if there's any glimmer or glow of any light whatsoever to see if anything's going on in there?
Wouldn't you get blasted with the infrared?
Yep, that's the moral of the story. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it can't blind you. So that is indeed the problem. When you freeze a green, inexpensive pointer laser, you disable both the neodymium crystal's ability to fluoresce and the frequency doubling crystal. So you have a very nice, strong, depending upon how much you paid for it or how much it was designed to carry, a lovely little near-infrared 808 nanometer laser pointed straight at your eyeball, cooking it. So yes, Ed, you are quite right. Just because you cannot see anything coming out of a laser, please, 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 do not stick your face in front of it. So that's the moral of that story. Let me kind of touch base with another puzzle that I put on my link page. There was this very weird site, a gentleman from Ukraine. I don't know the language, so I can't say exactly what he was talking about, but he appeared to be showing that he was able to bounce soap bubbles around using a laser pointer. And I also included some videos later on from different people who had better production values. So I'm wondering if anyone had a chance to look at any of them, and if anyone thinks that it's possible to bounce soap bubbles around using laser beams. Gosh, No one saw it? No one cared? I don't know. Again, if anyone saw it or would like to hazard any kind of a guess, please feel free.
Can you repeat the question? I didn't hear that.
Okay, Wesley. Last week I mentioned that on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, are some an image of a guy proposing to bouncing a soap bubble on a laser pointer. And there is a link to a YouTube from a gentleman in the Ukraine who seems to be demonstrating repeatedly bouncing his soap bubbles around with his laser pointer. And there are other videos of other people who are in the midst of discussing this concept.
This is WB2. See?
Yes, Cap.
Yeah, could the laser be, reacting or heating something in the atmosphere and basically creating convection currents to move the bubbles around?
That's what I was saying, WB2EAB.
Okay, that's a good idea because, and Dick has mentioned it before, we've talked about radiometers and a Crookes radiometer. And we've talked about light pressure and things moving because light beams are striking it. And a Crookes radiometer is not really about light pressure at all. It's about local heating. Because if you take a Crookes radiometer and suck out all the air inside of it and make it a vacuum, it doesn't work anymore. Because what it's really doing is the light on the reflective side isn't really absorbing locally, whereas the black side is, and heating the air around it and increasing the kinetic energy of the gas molecules and imposing a little momentum to make it twirl. So that's a good idea. Anyone else with any ideas of if this is possible and why this would be possible?
Interesting.
Yes, Wesley.
That reminds me of pretty much known science experiment, laser show in a soap bubble, and that is showing branch flow phenomena seen for the first time in visible light. So the researchers have created a branch flow phenomenon in visible light previously only seen in other types of wave-like sound. So now you have a two situation, one that we're dealing with photons and the other one that we were previously dealing with sound. Using nothing but laser and a simple soap bubble, scientists cause light to twist a fork along its path. So the hope was that there is a more light on that. I don't know how to say it, but it's not new thing. What I believe what is happening is a local heating of the structure. But you correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're going along with John and Ed with the idea that there's a local heating phenomena and it's heating up the air currents, and the air currents are causing the deflection of the soap bubble. So I would assume that all three of you are of a mind, and it makes logical sense if you had to kind of explain how the heck you could do that with a laser pointer and a soap bubble. That would probably be kind of your go-to answer offhand. But would you agree that you're basically agreeing with John and with Ed?
2H.
Yes, Lou.
Could it be a heating effect like in terms of a hot air balloon that bubble is actually expanding and heating and becoming more buoyant?
Well, that's an interesting one. It wouldn't probably present, if you've seen the link page, it looks as though it's kind of bouncing off the edge of the laser beam. So you would sort of think that if it was that type of phenomena, as you approach the laser beam into the central core of the bubble, you might demonstrate some additional movement up. But you know, the idea, if you look at even the still picture, that it's basically that soap bubble appears to just kind of be standing on the darn laser beam, as you can kind of see it in the photograph.
Yeah, I didn't look at the photograph. Is it some kind of surface tension type phenomenon?
Well, it depends on your definition of surface tension. In what way would you consider it a surface tension interaction?
Well, I guess a differential in the medium, whether it be temperature or density, and analogous, I guess, to surface tension on the top of the water, you know, a glass of water, something like that. So you have a force, I guess, perpendicular or parallel to the surface. So some change in medium.
Okay, that's very good. Anyone else with any ideas, please?
VDH with a comment.
Here's the again.
Okay, John, VDH, and then Ed.
Is it possible that the laser is heating, locally heating, a small region of the bubble's surface, and then this part of the bubble's surface rotates around to the top of the bubble, being warmer, and this causes the bubble to kind of act like it's rolling right on the light beam as new parts of the surface get heated by the laser? It kind of deflects to the upward part of the bubble surface.
Okay, that's a very interesting one. I would kind of question, though, if you could have such significant kinetic forces imparted to the soap bubble and still maintain the soap bubble. They're somewhat fragile. So that's a lot of kinetic energy that you're kicking into that surface layer that's basically transparent. Ed, you wanted to say something?
I believe you can calculate impact of the mass of the ions, but I believe that would be orders of magnitude too low to show any observable effect.
Yes, Wesley.
I can rule out momentum transfer from the laser, even though the radiation pressure is, I think, it is far from low to be noticeable. So from mass, we go to radiation pressure, which would be pi P equals I divided by C. The C is speed of light. It is determined by the intensity of I of the laser beam. So since the pressure is general is P equals FA, where F is a force and A is area, we could go to F equals I times A divided by C. So for the force, the result from the laser beam on an object, the A being the area of the beam, not an object. Since the A times I that times A is simply the power of the laser, you get the laser beam lies completely within the object of the surface area. So now we can compare it with the weight, not the mass of an object. The weight of an object is M times G. When M is a mass, G is gravitational acceleration on the Earth, ladies and gentlemen.
Hang on a sec. Roy, I meant photons, not ions. Back to us.
So, definitely, if you pick out assuming that laser in the video has a power of, let's say, 1 watt, which is definitely does not have a charging by the overall brightness on the shirt. I'm trying to see if there is a comparison that I could take which would somehow show a depression factor inside the bubble by the influence of laser beam. Let me just drop for a moment. There is definitely a thermal effect, and most of the time, bouncing in the clip looks like instantaneous to me. So it is something that takes effect under the influence. Am I right that we're dealing with the internal pressure change inside the bubble based on the influence of the laser beam?
Well, Wesley, that's one of the theories. I'm trying to kind of get some, and I have gotten some very clever, great ideas of trying to explain this that, you know, seems like magic tricks. So, you know, I'm kind of leaving it to all of you guys to come up with good reasons, and then I'll discuss what this is that we're watching.
Now, is it only taking place with the green laser beam and the soap bubbles? Could you help me out in that?
I believe that the gentleman from the Ukraine is only using a single laser pointer, and I believe it's green. I think that the other gentleman, and I will post their YouTube, which will be very informative and I hope enjoyable, they used a whole series of different lasers. I think they started with a 5 milliwatt, and they worked their way up to something like 10 watts. I'm trying to remember if they were all green. I do not specifically know. I don't remember. Let me put it that way.
I think I have some ideas. Let me try. I think that if the laser hits the bubble wall directly, the heat would make the wall collapse, but it needs a controlled experiment to study the interaction. But when we talk about a green laser beam, and we're talking about the rapid change of the light, well, the light deposits its energy on the bubble, and there is a change of the temperature, so we're talking about rapid change. Well, light is independent, but from the general knowledge, laser heating matters creates infrared radiation, which generates a heat in air. Now it needs that experiment to be controlled to find out if there is an illusion or there is a reality there. What I would like to point is that when you put the green laser into the fridge, you actually get infrared instead of green. Now, could we get a laser beam in green change into infrared based on the interaction with the soap?
Okay, it's a different subject, really. The fascinating thing about, again, it sort of depends on your green laser. Not all green lasers are designed the way inexpensive ones are. The inexpensive one uses a fluorescing crystal and then basically a doubler or an optical mixer. If they don't work, you only get the initial near infrared. Also, a reasonably good cheap green laser pointer should have an infrared filter on it, because some of the infrared is going to not be fluoresced and then doubled. It'll go right straight through. So most cheap green lasers will produce infrared, usually at about 808 nanometers. You can factor that in. The problem that I see with this, and I understand where all you guys coming from, and it makes sense. The problem, though, is that bubbles are transparent, so you're not going to get that much absorption. here, unless there's a lot of dust, is transparent. So you're not going to get a lot of heating of the medium. And also, soap bubbles are somewhat fragile. So if you really slam on the